Lecture 15, Husserl, Heidegger, and Phenomenology.
In this and the following lectures, I'd like to move firmly into the 20th century. The two philosophers we're going to be talking about are Martin Heidegger for three lectures, and then Jean-Paul Sartre for the rest of the course. But I want to begin with a philosopher who is not an existentialist at all, but whose philosophy so influenced both Heidegger and Sartre that we really can't understand what they did without him. I'm talking about Edmund Husserl, a Moravian or Czech-German philosopher who wrote at the very beginning of the 20th century. And what he did was he invented a method. The method is called phenomenology. And both Heidegger and Sartre began their careers as phenomenologists. Phenomenology is a version of Cartesianism, and Husserl at one point traces it quite explicitly back to Descartes. It includes a very strong emphasis on subjectivity, on consciousness. And the idea is that whatever we know about the world, whatever we know about objective truth, basically begins with and is based in consciousness as such. So phenomenology, very simply described, is the examination of consciousness, or literally, the examination of phenomena, that which appears to consciousness. One can summarize what Husserl had in mind by saying that phenomenology is the study of the essential structures of experience. What he was interested in was what makes experience possible. What makes our knowledge of objects possible? What makes, in fact, most importantly, the necessary presuppositions of experience possible? So when he talks about the structures of experience, what he's talking about, among other things, is how our acts of consciousness, as he puts it, relate to the objects of consciousness. Now, there is one concept, above all, that defines consciousness for Husserl. It is a notion which is borrowed from the scholastics in medieval times. It is the notion of intentionality. And let me explain it just very briefly by saying, intentionality is the thesis that consciousness is always about something. So if you believe something or other. If you perceive, you have to perceive something or other. If you have an emotion, say anger, you have to be angry about something or at someone. For Husserl, all consciousness is intentional in just this sense. But this is also a notion which lends itself to a certain kind of move, which, of course, in Descartes is absolutely central. Descartes talked about examining what we might call the ideas in consciousness, but with a kind of problem that surrounded this, that on the one hand, you examine your own subjectivity, and then the question is, how can you infer on the basis of your subjectivity to the reality of the world outside of you? This is sometimes referred to as the problem of solipsism, the idea of being caught in one's own consciousness. And Husserl very often comes dangerously close to the same problem, except that whereas Descartes insisted that he doubt all of his objective beliefs until he could prove them on the basis of his subjectivity, Husserl says that's going too far. That the things of our experience are, in fact, the things of the world, and it would be absurd to deny that. But for the purposes of phenomenology, we are interested in them just as objects of experience and not as objects of the world. Or to anticipate what I'm going to say about Heidegger, Husserl thinks that phenomenology is one thing, ontology, a study of the things of the world, is something different. In order to carry out his method, Husserl suggests that we make a couple of key philosophical moves. And the first and most important of them is what he sometimes calls the bracketing of the natural world. The idea here is that instead of simply taking our experience as the perception of things in the world, rather what I do is I suspend any judgment about the reality of things and I simply describe the objects of experience as such. For example, I might think that what I see is a horse. But on the other hand, I also can imagine a horse. I can also dream of a horse. And perhaps under some very strange conditions, I might hallucinate a horse. Even though the status of the reality of the horse is very different in those different cases, in each of them, I can describe what it is to experience the horse. So phenomenology wants to talk about my experiencing of the object and not particularly talk about what it is for that object to exist as a thing in the world. But Husserl, as I say, was not an existentialist. He was interested in none of the questions about the meaning of life and so on that we've been discussing. Rather, he came into philosophy from mathematics. And his interest in phenomenology grew out of a concern for the philosophy of arithmetic and the status of mathematical truths. What is it that makes 2 plus 2 equals 4 true? Is it simply a matter of convention? Is it a truth about some Platonic realm and some very peculiar entities? Is it simply a matter of logic? Well, what Husserl says is none of these. And basically, phenomenology is a way of talking about mathematical truth in terms of necessity, a very key element, and necessity in terms of the structure of consciousness. What Husserl seeks, as did Descartes, is a kind of certainty. And he thinks it's simply impossible to do what most philosophers have tried to do, which is somehow to derive certainty from our experience of the world. Rather, we have to understand certainty in terms of certain intuitions, which are basic to those particular experiences of the world. And you'll see a move like this very much in Heidegger too. In order to get the necessity that he seeks, what Husserl needs is what we might call an Archimedean point. Archimedes said, "Give me a place to stand and I'll move the earth." What Husserl wants is a place to stand in philosophy and to understand the nature of perception and mathematics and all the other things that we do. That place turns out to be what he calls the transcendental ego, or more generally, consciousness. And he shifts between consciousness and the transcendental ego for much of his career. It's a method in its basic outline that, as I said, greatly influences first Heidegger and then Sartre. But the ways in which they use it are going to be very far afield from the concerns and the introduction that Husserl gave it. Martin Heidegger was born at the end of the 19th century. He was a theology student as opposed to a mathematician. So we can guess right from the start that his concerns were going to be very closely tied to the concerns of human existence and the meaning of human life. The theological background is not insignificant, and there's a sense in which religion is going to permeate all of Heidegger's philosophy. And he writes very much in a kind of theological mode. His writings are notoriously obscure and difficult. And in the various interpretations that have been advanced of this very difficult work, one of them, and certainly one that predominates, is that there is something by way of a theological background, not necessarily the traditional notion of the monotheistic Judeo-Christian Islamic God, but rather something more innovative. And Heidegger often says in his work such things as, "Only a God can save us, and what we must do now is invent new gods." Heidegger is often referred to as an existentialist, and certainly I think that this is to a certain extent true, and that's why he's included here. But I should emphasize that it's really only his first great work, a work called Being and Time, which he never actually finished. He gave it up and started turning in a new direction. But nevertheless, I think Being and Time is so central to existentialist thinking that although Heidegger himself rejected the term, I think we need to characterize Heidegger as one of the great existentialist thinkers of the century. The concept that concerned him most, and in fact what being and time is all about, is what he calls the question of being. Right away, we get the sense that we're talking about something very profoundly philosophical. We get the sense that what we're talking about is something that is all-embracing, and that's exactly what Heidegger intends. He distinguishes between being and beings, or entities. And he says, through the history of philosophy, philosophers have worried about entities and what it is for them to exist and what they're really made of and how they relate to each other causally. But what they haven't sufficiently pursued is the question about what is the ground of being which makes the appearance of entities to us even possible? And this is the question that he wants to ask. And even though, as I say, he changes his philosophy after being in time, it is something like the question of being turned into later what he calls the history of being, which predominates in his philosophy. But being in time isn't really about being. It is a kind of preliminary work, a kind of preparation for asking the more serious questions that he simply anticipates. What goes on in being and time, in fact, is the examination of a very particular kind of being, what Heidegger refers to as the being through whom the question of being comes into question. And that is us. And here is where he first of all moves from what he calls the ontic dimension, namely the study of mere entities, to being more generally and the concern with being more generally, which he calls ontology, a very well-worn ancient philosophical term. Ontology is the study of being as such, but also it includes the study of the being through whom beings come into question, and that is ourselves. And like Husserl, he approaches philosophy from the first-person standpoint. Phenomenology, as I just discussed it, is the examination of our own subjectivity. With Heidegger, it takes on an added religious dimension, and there's a sense always in Heidegger, which increases with his philosophy, that there's a sense in which we are not so much active in the world, much less producing the world, but rather it's a sense of passivity. And Heidegger is fond of using words like the world disclosing itself to us, and the question of being becomes, under what conditions can things disclose themselves? It is phenomenology in the sense that it begins with our immediate experience. Although, let me say right now, and I will say many times again, Heidegger will not use at all words like experience or consciousness or mind. But if we begin with what I will call, because I don't have a substitute without using Heideggerian jargon, what I call my basic experience, it's a very different sort than what we find in a great many philosophers. In particular, the idea is that when I look at my experience, the first premise, the first realization, is not, as Descartes suggested, that I recognize myself as a thinking thing. My first experience is what Heidegger simply refers to as being there. It's the sense of here I am in a world. This sense of being here in a world, Heidegger gives the name Dasein. And Dasein is really the central feature of the whole of being in time. One might say that Dasein is us, and Heidegger says that Dasein is in each case mine, suggesting the first-person standpoint that Husserl and later Sartre would refer to. But he also suggests that Dasein is an important substitute for any such notions as, say, human consciousness. And I think this is actually an ingenious move. Dasein, literally translated, means just being there, being here in the midst of the world. But there's a presumption in phenomenology, and a presumption throughout the whole of modern philosophy, maybe back to ancient philosophy too, that when we examine our own experience, our own perceptions of the world, what we are very prone to do is to generalize very quickly and say, this is the truth about perception. This is how all people perceive. And perhaps even, this is how all rational creatures or all creatures perceive. Phenomenology has this very real problem, that if what I'm doing is studying the essential structures of my own consciousness, what grounds do I have for generalizing what I say and presuming that everyone else has the same kinds of conscious structures? Or to be a bit more pushy about it, why should I assume that, as many 18th century philosophers would say, that what I'm studying is human understanding or human experience or the human mind? I mean, couldn't the same structures be shared, say, by the great apes or perhaps by dogs? How far down the phylogenetic ladder does consciousness and its essential structures go? And on the other hand, thinking multiculturally, why should I assume that the essential structures of my experience are in fact the essential structures of any Homo sapiens experience? Cultural differences may make an enormous difference, and in fact Heidegger, especially in his later works, is perfectly willing to say that there are very different ways of perceiving the world, and some of them are much better than others. Ours, in fact, is not among the best. So this coinage, Dasein, is a very nice way of trying to do what Husserl wanted to do, namely get back to the basic primordial experience and say in what it consists. But whereas Husserl, like Descartes, thought that our basic experience was an experience, one might say, of the experience, or our experience of the objects of experience, what Heidegger wants to say is, no, our basic experience is a holistic, unified experience of our being in the world. And that phrase, being in the world, is the first important characteristic of Dasein. The second, which in many ways precedes it, is the idea that we are ontological. That is one of our essential traits. To say that we're ontological here is to say that we ask questions, and in particular, that we ask questions of being. But this doesn't necessarily mean asking the grandiose philosophical questions of being that Heidegger pushes us ultimately to ask. But rather, every time we question who we are, every time we are dissatisfied with the way we're performing, every time we are unsure about our place in a society or our place in a group, every time we are unsure about the world and we ask scientific questions, say, we are being ontological, asking questions of the world, and not just very particular questions, but questions which have as their basis some very global kind of conception or question. Heidegger doesn't use the notion of human being for the reasons I just stated, but also he doesn't use any of those notions which I just hinted at as proscribed. He doesn't talk about consciousness. He doesn't talk about subjectivity. He doesn't talk about the transcendental ego or the mind. And it's very important to see why he does not. Because as soon as you use that language, the question is consciousness versus what? Transcendental ego as opposed to what? And in Husserl, we get this picture of, on the one hand, there's consciousness, and then there are the objects of consciousness. And even if the objects of consciousness are in some sense in consciousness, then we raise the question, well, what about the objects out there in the world to which the objects of our experience presumably refer? And Heidegger thinks this whole way of thinking is utterly corrupt and utterly hopeless. The centerpiece of his philosophy is to reject all of this Cartesian tradition and say basically the whole distinction between being in the world and something else, between consciousness and the world outside of us, between the phenomenological world with its intentional objects and the possibility of the objects to which that refers. All that way of thinking leads us to nothing but paradox. The truth is, Dasein and the world are a unified phenomenon. To understand Dasein is to understand the world. Understand the world is to understand Dasein. And furthermore, quite the contrary of the idea that permeates a good deal of Western philosophy, that in some sense the self or the mind or the soul could exist independently of the physical world. In fact, philosophers have gone so far as to say there may be no material world, that all there is in some sense our minds, which are informed by God, and that gives us the experience that we have. But any suggestion of that sort simply leaves us in an impossible situation. What Heidegger wants to insist on is there can be no Dasein without the world. And at the same time, there can be no world without Dasein. So what he's saying here is, in a way, it's a return to what used to be called idealism, but to call it idealism would be really to miss the point, because the whole distinction between realism, the idea that there is a reality which in some sense we can know, and idealism, which is we know only in some sense the products of our own minds, really ignores the very bold move that Heidegger is trying to make, which is to say that Dasein already is being in the world, and being in the world cannot be separated into components, our being on the one hand, in the world on the other. Rather, we should think of being in the world as sort of like being in philosophy. It's not a spatial being in, it's rather, I am engaged in the world. And that's the first starting point of phenomenology. The idea of being ontological, and the idea of being self-questioning, is of course nothing new in philosophy. It certainly goes back to Plato, and Descartes, and Aristotle, and virtually every other philosopher you can think of. But the idea of rejecting consciousness puts all this in a new light, because one of the ways in which we tend to think of ourselves in philosophy, not surprisingly, is we think of ourselves in terms of consciousness. But the idea of rejecting consciousness means that a whole way of thinking about ourselves, for example, Descartes' thinking of ourselves as thinking things, or John Locke's thinking of ourselves in terms of our particular memories and so on, all that now goes out the board. And the question then is, where are we to find the self and self-identity? Because the old way of thinking about self and self-identity in terms of consciousness has now been displaced. I emphasize that when we're being ontological, the questions that really push to the fore are the questions we raise about ourselves. Who are we? What are we? But the nature of Dasein as simply being in the world, in a way, doesn't allow any easy answer to that question. In fact, it almost blocks it, because the whole picture of Dasein as nothing but engaged in the world raises the question whether Dasein has a particular identity. If so, what that identity might be. And as we'll see in the next lecture, what Heidegger wants to suggest is that what we think of as our self-identity, in fact, is a false self-identity. That what we think of as Dasein, in fact, is something very different from the individual self that we normally ascribe to ourselves. But talking about identity crises raises a question which to me is the most uncomfortable question talking about Heidegger's philosophy. And I guess the simple way to put it is, who was Heidegger? On the one hand, Heidegger was an indisputably brilliant philosopher, however obscure, who introduced some bold new ways of thinking into philosophy at, I think, just the right time. He was a young man coming out of theology who was very ambitious, and in fact, he started succeeding in those ambitions at a very early age. Being in Time was published in 1927, and he was already on his road to fame. But another man who was born not in Germany but in Austria the same year that Heidegger was, 1889, was also now on his road to fame, and that was Adolf Hitler. The two came together in the 1930s. Heidegger, at this point, was a successful academic with ambitions. Hitler was just about to become the Führer of Germany. And in 1933, Heidegger was made rector of the University of Freiburg with the support of the Nazis. What's more, Heidegger himself joined the Nazis. He gave many speeches in favor of the Nazis and the Nationalist Socialist program. He characterized it as the great new move in the world, not just in Germany, and it wasn't just German society that was to be saved, but Heidegger perceived Germany as literally the center of the earth, and it was from Germany that the entire earth would be reformed by way of the Nazi Party. In fact, Heidegger quit the Nazi Party by 1934, and in that sense, it was clear that he was already becoming disillusioned with some of its policies. But the reason why this causes me so much trouble, and anyone else who reads and especially likes Heidegger, is that following the war, he never repudiated the Nazi program at all. While he was still in the university, and during his life, during the war, he never questioned Nazi policies. And at the end of his life, the most that he really said was that the Nazi movement never achieved its potential greatness, that it became too much like the other technological societies, America and Russia. This raises some very serious questions. One of them is this: what do we think of a philosopher who has brilliant ideas, but nevertheless has what I will simply call a despicable past? Nietzsche said, the philosopher should be an example. And in particular, he should be an example of the philosophy. In Nietzsche's own case, as we saw, there's some question about how well he fulfilled that role. Nevertheless, I would argue that Nietzsche's writings and his personality were very much in tune with the sorts of things he wrote, however polemic and overstated they may have been. With Heidegger, it's a more difficult problem. It is often said that Heidegger's philosophy prefigures his Nazi enthusiasm. That perhaps has some basis, and I will, in the course of these lectures, say something about how that linkage might be made. But I think in general, it's greatly overstated. Heidegger's philosophy is so abstract, and in many ways so abstruse, that it's very hard to pull out a specific political program to which that philosophy was directed. On the other hand, there are philosophers who say the philosophy is one thing, the ideas can be defended independently, and Heidegger the man, hateful as he might have been, is really a side issue. It has nothing to do with a philosophical issue. But here I want to go back to Nietzsche and take him very seriously. The idea is that when we understand a philosophy, we have to understand the philosopher. And who the philosopher is has a lot to do with what the philosophy is. And I don't take this to be the kind of translation between ideas written down and ideas put into practice, so much as it's a holistic picture, something that Heidegger would certainly endorse. The idea that to understand the writings, we have to understand when they were written, the context in which they were written, the personality that produced them. And to understand Heidegger, therefore, is to make some sort of connection between his Nazi sympathies and his actual writings. It raises a more general question, too, about ethics. And this is particularly difficult with Heidegger because Heidegger greatly enjoyed making fun of ethics and making fun of those who fished in the muddy sea of values. He claimed that Being in Time was in no way an ethical work, nor did it have any ethical implications. Well, the truth is, it is impossible to read Being in Time without seeing that it has some very powerful ethical implications and tells us, in a very special way, how we should live our lives. But Heidegger would reject this. And because he rejects that, one also has to ask the question how much this stance of not doing ethics and not even implying ethics has to do with his own sense of not wanting to come to grips with the implications that his philosophy actually has. In talking about Heidegger, what I'm going to be trying to do is to simplify a very difficult philosophy. And let me give you one concept in particular, which I think is going to rule much of what he writes, including Being in Time. It's a distinction that comes back from the 19th century especially, and one thinks especially of Hegel. It's the idea of alienation. What bothers Heidegger from his early days in theological school is this problem of alienation, although he hardly ever talks in those terms. The terms he uses is the idea, the ideal, of feeling at home in the world. The truth is, Heidegger did not feel at home. The truth is that he claims that modern man doesn't feel at home, that mass consumerism and technology have made it impossible for us to feel at home on the earth. And somehow making good this concept and this notion of feeling at home is going to be, in many ways, the motivating force behind Heidegger's philosophy. And it's not surprising that in his life in the Black Forest, after he finished with his professional career, he often emulated the life of a simple German peasant, which, by the way, is how he interpreted the Nazi Party as well. And to use that as an image behind this very difficult thinking I think will give us a handhold on a way of understanding Heidegger that is not always evident in the prose itself.